first, it's time to check in on some of the top stories of the week in national politics. Three other states held primary elections last night. We'll look at those results. Former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort's trial is wrapping up after the defense declined to call any witnesses. And the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus is opposing changes to the Democratic Party's superdelegate system for presidential primaries. And you can weigh in on our question of the week. Do you think the Democratic National Committee should reconsider the role of superdelegates? Do they unfairly stack the guests? Get deck against outsider candidates? Should they be made to vote the way their states do? Or do you think elected officials should have the power to vote for the candidate of their choice? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Ested Herndon is a national politics reporter for the New York Times. He's also a graduate of Marquette University. Ested, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, we'll talk in depth later in the show about the Wisconsin primary, but let's touch on it. At least four states, including Wisconsin, held primaries last night. What have people from outside the state been saying about the election here, and how high has interest been?
Yeah, certainly the Wisconsin races come November are ones that folks are watching in Washington and throughout the country. I mean, certainly the top ticket billing there is the governor's race. And I think that both of those primaries went the way that we kind of expected in terms of having a real top-tier candidate that most of the party establishment wanted in Tony Evers. But you had a couple of the big prediction firms move that race from lean Republican to just a pure toss-up yesterday, just because there's going to be so much energy around the Democratic side. And then when you look down ballot, you have, of course, the race to replace Speaker Ryan, and I think that we, again, have both the primary winners that we kind of expected there. And so while yesterday gave us a finalized picture, so where the place that people are really going to be looking at for Wisconsin is certainly going to be in November.
Well, there may not have been any really big surprises, as you said, in Wisconsin, but it was a different story elsewhere. Let's first turn to Connecticut, where a teacher scored an upset in the Democratic congressional primary. Tell us what happened there.
Yeah, it was a really interesting race. You had a primary, an open seat out in central Connecticut, the 5th district, and you had kind of your classic progressive versus moderate battle. You had a party, establishment party person who had been backed by the Democratic Party and kind of the conventional Connecticut folks, and Merrick Glassman, and who was kind of always expected to win. And she ended up facing a challenger who was a former Teacher of the Year back in 2016, who had this kind of viral moment with Barack Obama, who had been a child of the district, and really just got a lot of energy around the race. She was someone who supported Medicaid law and raising the minimum wage and some of the more progressive programs. And she ended up winning not only she ended up winning yesterday, but actually in a landslide. And so that was something that really jumped out, was not only that she won, but that the energy and enthusiasm around her was so big that she won almost by 30-something points. And so another big win for that wing of the party, who has been wrapping up a couple in those safe Democratic districts, even though statewide they may have struggled.
Let's turn now to Vermont. There was another first, this time for either party. Democrat Christine Hallquist became the first transgender nominee for a governor's seat. What kind of platform did she run on?
Again, another one of those progressives. I mean, she is someone who backed a increase in minimum wage, another supporter of Medicare for All, and she was the favorite. It was a win that was expected, but historic nonetheless. The problem that she's going to have come November is that this is a very popular governor she's going to be up against. And so certainly there's going to be renewed interest in the driving in this campaign. There's a historic campaign, but it's going to be a difficult one nonetheless. It's interesting that even in those blue states up in New England, places that supported Hillary Clinton in 2016 and overwhelmingly had Democratic members of Congress, you still see these very popular Republican governors who have been very hard to unseat, and she's going to have an uphill battle trying to do that.
So, Ested, the Democratic Party views itself as a Big Ten party that's inclusive and wants to include everyone. Do you think results last night helped to shore up that reputation.
Yeah, and something yesterday that really stuck out are a lot of these firsts. We mentioned Vermont and the transgender woman who has become the nominee, but you also had Ilhan Omar win out in Minnesota, Somali-American, the first Somali-American ever elected to public office, and she's now won that seat that Keith Ellison is leaving in Minnesota, and she'll likely become one of the first Muslim women to ever serve in the U.S. Congress. You had last week Rashida Tlaib, another Muslim woman, win her primary in Detroit and will become another one of the first Muslim women to serve in Congress. And you have these kind of pockets popping up left and right across the Democratic Party. While you certainly have more traditional figures, you know, out in Wisconsin with the governor nominee, but you also have some more historic ones as well that the party says is proof that it's trying to diversify and make its caucus look a little more like America. There has been so much criticism of Democrats for how old and how white, especially their congressional leadership is. And it's funny, kind of ironic, that it's taken a Donald Trump presidency to really see a new wave of people come in who are sure to shake things up once they get to D.C.
Before we move on to another topic, I want to stay in Minnesota for a second. And U.S. Representative Keith Ellison won the Democratic nomination for attorney general in Minnesota. But this comes just days after he was accused of physically abusing his ex-girlfriend. How do you think this is going to play out? How is the Democratic establishment treating this?
Yeah, we had the first response from the Democratic National Committee yesterday, which said they are looking into the allegations. Representative Ellison is, of course, the deputy chair of the Democratic Party. So that's why these have taken a little more, these have taken even a bigger national significance than just for any member of Congress. It's interesting because these have been things that have been circling around, particularly in Minnesota, for a while. And news outlets have gone back and forth about reporting on it because there had been no way to kind of corroborate the allegations. They actually blew up when the accused, his ex-girlfriend's son, posted about it on Facebook, and it ended up going viral and then picked up by conservative media, who has been, you know, historically tried, even in the last year and a half, to really weaponize these allegations against Democrats. What we know is that the ex-girlfriend, I believe her name is Karen Monahan, has said that a video exists of the representative dragging her from the bed, and that she experienced both emotional and physical abuse during her years-long relationship. And the representative has denied it and said there is no video because it never happened, and that he did not engage in that behavior. No one has seen this video. The woman said that she has misplaced it, and so that's kind of the state of play right now. But you have, at least yesterday, there was some question whether voters would take this into mind and whether it would weigh on his numbers for that attorney general nomination. And the answer to that is a resounding no. Voters in Minnesota, you know, backed him largely, overwhelmingly, for that attorney general nomination, which will put him in a prime position come November to be one of the leading law enforcement people who are going up against Donald Trump.
We're talking with Ested Herndon. He's a national politics reporter for The New York Times, and he's bringing us up to speed on some of the top stories of the week. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. We'll be turning to the topic of superdelegates in just a moment. What do you think their role should be in the Democratic presidential primary process? Should their role be reduced or done away with completely? Or do you think concerns about the influence of superdelegates are overblown? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. We're continuing our conversation with Ested Herndon. He's a national politics reporter for The New York Times, and we're talking about some of the top political stories of the week. And Ested, as we've been saying, the Democratic National Committee is meeting later this month to consider changes to the superdelegate system in their presidential primary process. And this week, Cedric Richmond, chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus, recommended against the changes. First of all, what changes are the DNC considering?
Mm-hmm. So after the, you may remember back in 2016, there was such a blow up around the superdelegate process, particularly supporters of Senator Bernie Sanders said that the process was rigged against outsiders, partly because these are people who are not bound to vote in the way that the constituents vote. Now, we should mention that these delegates have never overturned the will of the people in the party's history, but it still creates this perception that maybe they could. And so it's been something that folks have latched in on, so much so that there was a commission that was put into place after 2016 to figure out how to fix these issues. And one, the thing that they came up with, which is now going to be voted on finally in the next month, is a way to make them kind of symbolic, at least on the first vote. It's kind of in the weeds and very political, but when you get to the Democratic Convention, on the first vote, where delegates will have a chance to nominate who the Democratic nominee will be, none of those superdelegates will be able to vote. It will only be pledge delegates, so people who vote exactly how the American people vote. And so that means that if a person has the amount of votes to win on that first ballot, the superdelegates will play no role in the process. Now, they could play a role in the process if it goes on and maybe there's something like a contested convention or something like that. So it's a little complicated, but what they did was largely make those superdelegates symbolic so that only the will of the people will control who the Democratic nominee is on that first ballot.
And Sed, remind us who those superdelegates are exactly.
Mm-hmm. Now, these are people who are party leaders, former elected officials, state party chairs, people that are kind of deemed the party's elite. So you have folks like members of the Congressional Black Caucus and folks like members of state parties who have enjoyed special access to candidates. So when someone goes out and runs for president, they'll do two things. They'll try to convince the American people to vote for them, but there'll be this other primary that's happening at the same time where they would convince these superdelegates to try to pledge their votes to them because that was another way to shore up that nomination. What the Democratic Party has done is really dilute that power of those folks, which have riled up some people, as you mentioned.
Well, and what specifically was Cedric Richmond saying made him oppose this process? And he also said he was speaking for other members of the Congressional Black Caucus.
Right. Now, there's a particular concern among some minority members that if you dilute that power, these candidates will not listen or come to these folks in the same way. So right now, people like Cedric Richmond and other members of the Congressional Black Caucus are treated specially by presidential candidates who then have to come to them and they say they can voice concerns about African-American communities and what's important to their communities and force those candidates to listen to them. Their argument is if you take away that power, that gives the candidates less of an incentive to do that. Now, there's people who come on both sides of that. They say that folks will still have to listen because, you know, African-American voters are a big part of that population in the Democratic primary, so that there's no reason why the Congressional Black Caucus should enjoy more access than regular old voters. But that's his argument that he's making. And they have been someone who they've been a group that's been really keyed in on these big process fights because the Congressional Black Caucus tends to be older and they get a lot of their power in Washington based on seniority. So they're very sensitive to changes in that aspect because they think it can come back to hurt some of the most senior minority leaders in Washington.
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. John in Madison is up. Hi, John.
Hi. I get the general impression that these parties are more private institutions than they are public institutions. So as that, they're pretty much free to do what they want, in my book. That being said, I think it behooves them to go against their voters in any way, which is probably why they have the superdelegates go with what their voters want in general anyway. That being said, it still was kind of sketchy when they were pledging to Hillary before even finding out how the primaries did. What thoughts does he have about superdelegates pledging their votes to somebody before they find out what the voters are doing, even though he says that they'll vote how the voters will do anyway?
Great. Thanks for that point, John. And instead, that's a good point, you know, going with the voters. But but if they can choose to pledge before, how does that work exactly?
Right. It's hard. And so it creates a weird perception, which I think is what he's isolating, that even before my state, let's say I'm in Wisconsin, has had a chance to vote, there can be party leaders who have already said, I'm giving my vote to this person or that person. And so so even though that has never happened to a degree which overturned the will of the people, it does create a weird perception that maybe this is not a democratic function. Maybe this is a weird institution. And so that's what the party is really trying to change. And so that perception that he's keying in on is actually what the party is trying to proactively trying to insulate itself from that criticism and saying, you know what, going forward, after 2016, we're not going to do that. And so the only time these people will ever become important is if there is extraordinary circumstances, and that the voters can rest assured that it's only going to be their vote that's going to choose the nominee.
Let's go next to Helene in Madison. Hi, Helene.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What would you like to say?
Well, I agree with the change that's been discussed because I find that in my experience, anytime a candidate for any election or primary comes in with giving a perception that they feel that it's their turn and they've earned it, that voters do not respond to that type of entitlement feeling. And I think that the perception, your guest said, that it's not democratic and it's not according to the vote. I was recently very surprised that within the past month I was speaking with a person in his 20s who said he actually had been a Bernie Sanders supporter in the Democratic Party, but he ended up voting for Trump because he resented so much what it came out that the DNC and the establishment had done to Bernie Sanders in favoring Hillary. So,
and Helene saying that, you know, it sounds like there might be kind of a split between the everyday voters and the establishment. Does that sound right to you, Estead?
Certainly, yeah. And this is why these issues came up, is because Bernie Sanders particularly was able to whip up support among kind of the rank-and-file Democrats or people who were voting Democrat in the primaries to say that this is unfair, and that why party leaders, they're still now kind of remiss and sad that the old system's leaving, but there's a recognition that the people want to see these changes. And so actually these changes are part of a broad sweeping reform that you're seeing from the Democratic Party, which includes trying to get new voters, make it easier to register for primaries, new data techniques that allows them to target people who may have not voted before, particularly minorities. It's part of a wide array of changes the party is trying to do to make itself more accessible. But we should also say that Donald Trump, and also we now know through the Russia investigation that some outside actors were trying to whip up this anti-democratic energy and saying that the Democratic Party was cheating. And so some of these sentiments were even played on by the opposite side, the Republican side.
I want to move now to the White House and Omarosa Manigault Newman, a former contestant on The Apprentice and a former communications director in the Trump administration, has been releasing tapes she made during her time in the White House. What kinds of things did she get on tape, Estead?
Yeah, it's she has a wide array of things. I mean, first thing she released was her firing from Chief of Staff John Kelly. There had been much confusion about what actually was said in that meeting. And the first thing she did when she is coming out, of course, with a book, which is part of this process, she released a tape of him saying things like, you know, if you remain loyal, you know, things won't come out about you. And these kind of like vague or veiled threats about how she must conduct herself when she leaves the White House if she doesn't want, you know, bad things to come out about her. And so and then she's also released some tapes after that, which has some Trump advisors, some African-American Trump advisors, Katrina Pearson, the spokeswoman, and Lynn Patton, who currently serves in the administration, worrying about an alleged tape of President Trump saying the N-word and what they would do about it if it came out. And so she's really stirring the pot here, and of course it's provoked a response from the president, which has only escalated the feud. This is someone who he's known for a very long time. This is someone who is very close to him. And on Twitter, And through his press secretary and surrogates, they've now been calling her things like a dog and wacky and deranged, which is only fueling the fires even more.
And one of the tapes, at least, that she's released is a phone call between herself and President Trump. Let's listen to a short clip of that.
Marosa, what's going on? I just saw in the news that you're thinking about leaving. What happened?
General Kelly came to me and said that you guys wanted me to leave.
No, I nobody even told me about it. Nobody.
Wow.
You know, they run a big operation, but I didn't know it. I didn't know that.
So that's a very interesting, only about, 17, 18 seconds there, but a very interesting peek into maybe how things work in the White House.
Yeah, all these tapes have been fairly revealing. We've known that this White House is chaotic. We've known that it's decentralized. But the idea that the president would not know about the firing of someone which he was solely responsible for putting there. I mean, Omarosa is his personal friend. I mean, she remained there not because of expertise about the issue or because of some history in the Republican Party. She was there because of her relationship with the president. So the idea that he would not know that, or at least was telling her that he did not know that, is just a window into the amount of chaos that surrounds this West Wing. But there's been some questions now about whether she breached security by taping folks in the West Wing and in the Situation Room. But also, if Omarosa is able to tape people, who else has tapes? There's been international actors there. There's been a lot of other people who have had access to this president. And if things like this are able to be done, the sky is limitless.
Well, Ested, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ested Herndon is a national politics reporter for the New York Times and a graduate of Marquette University. He was with us to recap some of the week's top stories.